The meeting will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so we'll start right out with House File 70. Representative Hosh, if you could come forward, please. Welcome to the committee of Representative Erdahl. Do you have a member of the committee to move your bill, Representative Hosh, or would you like me to move it?
It would be wonderful if you could move it, Madam Chair.
I will do that as soon as we have a quorum then. But in the meanwhile, and you have an amendment, but we can't offer that without a quorum either. So if you could just go ahead and start explaining your bill, and when we do move it, I will move it for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and that's what we'll do with all the bills that are being considered today, and that's what we do with all the bills in this committee. So they never go anywhere, they just stay here waiting and hoping to get in the omnibus bill, and there's no vote, so this is a nice, easy, friendly committee, as Representative Erdahl knows, because he served on K-12 many times. So please proceed and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 70 is a bill that would assist the Eden Valley Rockland School District in some mercury cleanup expenditures that has hit the school district this year. You may have seen some of the stories in the Star Tribune and on NPR and throughout the state with the challenges that the school district had. With this issue. Representative Erdahl is with me because he represents the Watkins and the southern Eden Valley half of the school district. I don't want to talk too much as we have the superintendent here to talk about the issue, but I do want to give a little bit of a plug for the school district and hope that you can take this proposal seriously. The school district is one of three schools in the entire state that has been given a national award by Standard & Poor's, and they are the only school in the state who received a 100% score on their state writing test, and they are the, well, not reigning, but just 2 years ago, the state football champions also. So it's a wonderful school in our community.
A well-rounded student body.
Very well-rounded, and that's what you find in central Minnesota. But with that in mind, I don't want to talk too much. I would like the experts to speak or answer any questions of the committee.
All right. Representative Erdahl, did you want to add a word or wait till later?
Just very briefly, echoing Representative Hosh's comments that Eden Valley Watkins is a very deserving community. I believe their eighth graders were number three in the state in their MCAs last year. So without further ado, let's bring up Superintendent Peterson.
Thank you, Representative Hosh and Representative Erdahl. Do we have a quorum yet? We don't. Okay. Superintendent Peterson, if you could, and also Thielen?
Correct, ma'am.
Very good. Just like Greiling, the second vowel is pronounced. I like it.
Yep.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could, as each of you speak, if you could identify yourselves for the tape, please.
Yeah, I'm Superintendent Larry Peterson, and this voice is from 35 years of being in education.
All right. Superintendent Peterson, there are many teachers on this committee who would understand exactly what you're saying.
To give you a little overview, the man next to me is my business manager, Nick Thielen. He also serves as our health and safety coordinator. So he got directly involved in this as we went through the process. So I'll start us out a little bit on what happened. On a Tuesday, December 5th, it was, we were nearing the end of the day, and our science teacher asked his teacher assistant to take an old barometer down to our chemical and health safety person to be disposed of properly, where the University of Minnesota would come out and pick it up. And on the way, that person ended up going through a shop area and dropped it. It was an old barometer of which was a quarter full of mercury in it. Lo and behold, I've listened to people talk about how they played with it when they were in school and everything else. We're in a different world now. And that set in stage a whole series of events that led to our cleanup situation. I'll let my health and safety coordinator talk about what happened then.
Mr. Thielen.
Yes. Basically what happened after we were informed.
If you could also identify yourself again with your title for the tape.
My name is Nick Thielen, business manager with the Eden Valley Watkins School District. I also was filling in an interim basis as a health coordinator, indoor air quality health safety coordinator for the school district.
Thank you.
At this time. Basically, after we were informed of a mercury spill down in the shop area, we went down. I went down and assessed the situation down there, and I, at that time, took the students and quarantined them, those that I had there. We also got a hold of our science hygiene officer, a science lab upstairs. She came down with a mercury kit that she has available for the science lab up there. At the time that she was coming down, I did call Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and ask them what kind of situation we had on hand at the school district. They informed me at that time that it was not too serious of a situation, that we probably could scrape it together and put it in a container and turn it into the University of Minnesota for proper disposal. Our science lab official, when she got down there, she used her kit, and by using that kit, it showed the mercury spill that was on the floor in the shop area and stuff like that, and right away she assessed that that was a bigger spill than we could handle within the school district. So upon that, I called the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and they told us that what we should do was vent out the building, quarantine the area and the students, which we already did, but the 5 minutes, 10 minutes that transpired in between here, there was a switch of classes, and there was also traffic going in that area. So that's a little bit why it got tracked a little bit throughout the district. But more so, it got spread through the district by the indoor air ventilation system that was in the building. Mercury is dangerous in a vapor form more so than a solid form. Talking with the Minnesota Department of Health, when they came through, they told us that the substance of mercury is not necessarily harmful for the individual. It's the vapor that gets in our lungs, and that causes hazardous for people. So upon that, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, they sent out a team. They did not inform us as far as the severity of the situation. We still had our wing quarantine off and everything like that. They also told us to get a hold of Bay West, a hazardous waste cleanup company. They came out and they said they were going to clean up the area. We assumed that we'd be able to have school the next day. Needless to say, after they got out into the building and they started doing their tests with their machines, and they found out the vapor was throughout the whole building as far as the vapor was in the building, we were pretty much informed that we had to shut down. We shut down for three days, actually, we shut down, plus Saturday and Sunday, excuse me, for the cleanup. And during that period of time, Bay West was within the building was sealed off, and a cleanup process had to be done where the air quality of the building had to be all flushed out with fresh air. And pretty much the procedure, other than picking up the mercury spill itself, was to get fresh air in the building. And you had to open up the doors, windows, and everything, and pretty much just air out the building is the major thing. So. The cost of the mercury spill from Bay West amounted to $102,165, but in the process there was equipment that had to be disposed of in the school district. We lost vacuum cleaners, we lost walk-off mats, we lost furniture, carpet areas. The vapor get in the carpet and they cannot get it out of the carpet, they informed us, so they just pretty much took those items and disposed of them, and we had to replace them. So we had a cost of the school district of roughly about $23,129 to replenish the equipment and furnishings that we lost in the spill there. So our request from the state legislator is $126,000 for the spill. Where we're in another difficult situation is that with our scores and stuff like that that we've been maintaining, our philosophy in our school district is keep classes on the small size. We're a small school district. We keep classes at a small size. In my budget that I submit to the school board every year, we stick pretty rigid in this pretty tight budget. I do not have $120,000 laying around extra without going to SOD. So if the school district itself would have to absorb this here, the cost of this mercury spill, we would be in SOD next year for sure, and we'd be short of funds available, I guess.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask if there are any questions for the two of you, and then we'll bring the author back up so we can get the bill moved and get the amendment amendment on, which does reflect that amount of money that you just mentioned, $126,000. Representative McFarland.
Yes, Madam Chair and presenters. Did you have any insurance coverage on this? And anything?
We did.
Mr. Thielen.
Yes. I checked upon our insurance coverage at the time, and it's unfortunate, but majority of school districts in Minnesota would not have coverage for a mercury spill. You would find out that if a accident happened where a car, and just what the insurance company informed me, is that if a car would penetrate a wall, caused a mercury spill, they would clean it up. But the accident of a dropping of a chemical within the building is not covered underneath insurance.
Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and gentlemen. I'm looking at documentation submitted to us from Bay West.
Yes.
Did the Board of Education put this project out on bids?
Mr. Superintendent Peterson.
There's only two companies in the state that possibly can do this, that are licensed to do it, that can do it. And that's what MPCA had told us. They recommended one of the two. He ended up calling the one that was available to come out right away, and that was Bay West.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Do you recall offhand who the other company was?
It's a company down in the cities here. Do you know the name, Nick?
I do not recognize the name.
But it's out of the cities, much as Bay West was.
Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, when I called down there, they recommended Bay West. They said they are the highest qualified team to come out there and do the job that we need done in our school district. And they recommended, upon their recommendations, we took them as our service.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Van Zelko. I do want to point out that the handout that you have, that invoice, is just one invoice. I want that to be a piece of reference that the committee could look at it to actually see what the costs were associated with this cleanup.
Okay. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either one of you, I guess, what percentage of your annual operating budget is the $126,000 that you were required to spend on this?
Mr. Thielen.
Yes. Our general fund budget for the year is we usually receive $525,000 is what our budget was last year. $5,525,000
was last year.
Okay.
Second question. Were you able to access funds under the Safe Schools Levy to help with this kind of a cleanup?
Mr. Thielen.
Yes. We were informed upon the incident here, and we talked to the Minnesota Department of Education about funding sources. They said that we were allowed to do a direct levy on our taxpayers in our school district. This happened the first part of December. I just finished with my truth and taxation hearing December 4th. We had a 15.5% increase in levy on our school district. This amount here would have actually doubled the levy on the school district. We have a good rapport with our citizens in our community, and we did not think that, honestly and truthfully, we could assess them another double their levy without a hearing or public input into it.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Mr. Thielen, was that your capital budget that you were mentioning, the $500,000?
The capital budget, my capital outlay budget is about $200,000 a year.
So what was your total budget altogether?
My total budget, my total revenue in general fund is $5,525,000.
Okay. Thank you very much. Members, any other questions? Otherwise, I will move House File 70, and then we'll move Amendment A2. On to that bill. Is there any discussion on Amendment A2? Does everybody have it? It's adding in the $126,000 and that they may recognize the revenue in fiscal year 07. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Hosh, do you have anything else to add? Any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for their time on this. I know that we're all busy, but this is very important for our community. This is an unfortunate incident that happened within Eden Valley Watkins School District, and as you heard before, to levy this would be quite a burden on our community members and homeowners when it would double the levy in in essence. Even with a $5 million budget, we know that the majority of that is coming from state revenues. I do appreciate your support. Hope that we can have this in the omnibus bill before the end of session, and that should be it.
Representative Heigerken, is it real urgent because we want to keep on
the
schedule?
Just one question. I need to know, Mr. Peterson, I thought first it was Representative Ward talking. I'm glad we identify with speakers when they do talk in the mic. But question being maybe more for Mr. Kroll. Was my understanding one time there used to be a fund of money for catastrophic events? The school district had, am I wrong in that?
Mr. Things Kroll.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerk and I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
We had a certain funding stream, and it wasn't catastrophic, but something along those lines, but there isn't anything like that now.
Thank you, Representative Heidgerk and Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, and just want to thank the committee for their attention to this matter. It was a unforeseen accident, and certainly hope that you could help Eden Valley Watkins remedy the situation.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Superintendent Peterson. And
thank you, Kevin.
Absolutely. And members, there is a fiscal note that goes along with this bill. When we hear Representative Kranz's bill next, and Representative Kranz, please come forward. I'm going to ask Mr. Crow to just basically explain a fiscal note, since these are the first fiscal notes, I think, that we've had in front of this committee, and they're pretty straightforward, but just in case anyone has any questions. And Representative Kranz, before we start with your bill, could I have a motion from the committee to approve the minutes of February 15th?
So moved.
Okay, I guess I'm going to take Representative Faust, because I saw his hand before I heard the voices over here. So Representative Faust moves approval of the minutes of February 15th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Representative Kranz, welcome to the committee, and I would move House File 249 be recommended to be laid over onto the for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I have to get it out myself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. House File 249 is actually kind of a unique situation where one of the three school districts that I represent, Independent School District 16 or Spring Lake Park, is actually experiencing some growth, so much so that they went to their taxpayers and levied $92 million to improve and expand the high school. When they did this, they had a comprehensive study that was over a two-year process and included all of the people involved in the community, and they looked at everything from building a brand new high school to renovating the one that we currently have. And when they did that, the Department of Education said, really, if you want to build a high school, you need 60 acres. They could not even find a plot of land in our school district that had 60 acres, so they went to Plan B. Currently there are plans with that $92 million to build a new elementary school up in the northern part of Blaine, which is a newer developing part of our district. And what they currently have is they have a high school, a district office, a district bus, a district garage, an elementary school, and a community services all on 35 acres. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was is they looked at an alternative site. A local health partners clinic was moving also to the newer parts of Blaine, and so the health partners clinic in Spring Lake Park was purchased based on a lease levy agreement to add classroom size. And the original plan was to put the community service and possible learning alternative program in that site. As they looked further into it, they said, you know what, this is just not going to work. We want to make the high school site bigger. So they're moving in the direction of having the high school and the learning alternative site only on the high school campus. Moving the elementary, the district garage, and the district offices will be moved to this new site. Long story short, they've already raised the revenue for this. They've had a great deal of public support in doing this. They need the okay to spend those dollars in a non-classroom building that will actually make a lot of sense. And it happens, I'm told, and in fact you have information in front of you, a couple of school districts every year or every biennium are looking at doing this based on expansion. So at this point in time, I think I've explained it pretty well, and I'll yield to questions.
And members, I just looked at the fiscal note. There is no impact, so this isn't really a very good one.
Yeah.
We'll wait until the next one.
Whoa.
Mr. Crow?
Madam Chair, not to contradict you, but it's actually a good example of of a fiscal note in one sense. If you compare it with our last bill, this committee has deals with things that have local property tax impacts, and they are of concern for you. You'll get a property tax target, and you'll need to know how much property taxes go up because of your bill. A fiscal note on the front page only shows the state general fund cost, but so if you look at House File 70 fiscal note, you see the $126,000 on the front page of the fiscal note. But for this bill, there is no cost listed on the front page, and that doesn't mean that there isn't any cost. It just means there isn't any state cost. So if you look at the back, and if this is a good time, I'll just do a quick rundown of the fiscal note.
Mr. Crow, you can contradict me anytime. Obviously, you've got very good information here. And members, I think this is a very good instructive thing to take the fiscal note from Representative Hosh's bill and then the fiscal note from Representative Kranz's bill, and then we're comparing them, and it's very helpful, obviously, for me, too.
So if you look at the back, on all fiscal notes, you'll kind of see it. You'll see a general structure that's the same, and that's the bolded headings with the underlines. The initial is just a description of what the bill does. Then an important section to look at is assumptions, and this is where you'll see if a bill, for example, raises the cap on equalization or on operating referendums. This is where you'll see assumptions about how much new referendums, for example, we assume will get passed, any assumptions about things that aren't specified in the bill are kind of detailed here. And sometimes they're assumptions based on fact. For example, that the department called the district. You can see in paragraph 2, based on information from the district, the building where administrative space will be relocated is under a capital lease with annual payments of $263,000. So that's where they're getting their calculations for the instructional space. And then you look down and you see expenditure revenue formula. If there's a formula built into the bill, that's where it'll be detailed. If there are long-term fiscal considerations, those will be here. This bill has none because of the information under local government costs. And this is where you would see additional levy impact if there is levy impact in the local school district. Now the reason that this doesn't have a levy impact is that we've been looking at administrative leases over the last couple of years, we've had districts come in and say, if you don't give us this authority, we're going to have to lease classroom space under our lease levy. And then we're going to, because that's what we can do, that's what's allowable under statute, and then we'll use other space that we have for the administrative offices, where sometimes it's cheaper for districts to actually go out and, because of the space requirements, the unique requirements of the space that they're leasing, it's cheaper to actually lease the administrative space. So this is kind of one of those but-for questions. If we didn't have the bill, or but-for the bill, they would go out and levy anyway. So there really isn't levy savings, it's levy cost. It's just allowing them to levy for a different purpose. And the author has included a couple of examples from previous year's bills where we've gone into more detail, where we basically say that the school district is allowed to make the levy for administrative purposes, but only if they certify that they would otherwise levy for instructional purposes, which is usually more expensive. So on the one hand, they're saving money. On the other hand, they're levying it, and we just say, okay, there's no net levy impact for a bill of this type, if that's the case. Now, there have been cases where districts have come in and said, we want a levy for administrative space, and there is no net offsetting reduction in classroom space lease amounts, and so we've actually carried a levy cost for that kind of change and said, okay, if we allow this bill, there's going to be a net of $100,000 or a couple $100,000 a year of higher school district property taxes in the state because of this particular change. So when you're looking at your fiscal note, you want to look at the first page for your general fund impacts, and then under it, you also don't want to ignore the local government costs, which are at the bottom of the last page, and that's where you'll see the levy impact of various bills. And just process-wise, fiscal notes are completed by the Department of Education and then signed off on by the Department of Finance. So if you're wondering where your fiscal note is, it's usually somewhere in that process. And I consult with the Department of Finance and Department of Education on the fiscal notes that are being done. And so I can answer questions you have about them at any point during the process, too, or if you have a bill coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. That was very, very helpful. And anytime there is a bill coming up, then our committee administrator works with Mr. Crow to make sure we have the fiscal note. But if you want information ahead of time, you can definitely talk to Mr. Crow so you're not broadsided by it. So it looks like we have a nice, clean bill here. And members, anytime we have a lot of bills that are questioning a current law that we have, like obviously we have for this one, I always think it's fair game if anybody is interested in, you know, bringing forward a bill to actually change the law so we don't have to keep listening to these little bills as we're micromanaging the local school districts. But having said that, it is never very popular to have any kind of a bill in support of anything to do with administrators, so we might be left with this. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would hope that as we probably lay this bill over, that we would consider adding that restrictive language that has been in prior bills that deal with the leasing administrative space. So we're good to administration, but we also say, you know, it needs to, you need to demonstrate school district to the commissioner's satisfaction that the administrative space is less expensive than instructional space. So I hope we'll consider that.
That's a very good suggestion, and maybe Mr. Kranz, Representative Kranz, will, you know, care to let us know if he wants that added on as well.
Yeah,
Kranz, do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, if there's a need, I'm actually pretty close to this situation, and I believe that the school district is acting with that intent. Like I said, there was a great deal of public interest in this $92 million increase. So they've really been very careful about how they've proceeded. So, but if that makes the committee feel better, please let me know, and I'll look into that.
Okay, thank you very much.
They're
probably looking at the cost savings for wanting to do this in the first place. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kranz, is the school district currently leasing a school building for purposes of instructional use? Is that what I read until the year 2022?
The original intent was to lease that Health Partners building for the idea of instructional use. They've gone on and actually purchased that. Well, it's a levy, but they've levied that building right now, at least that building. And what they're doing is basically in all the analysis, they figured out that, you know, it really would be better served to get the district office off the high school campus and more cost effective to build those classrooms in at the high school campus. And so they've already moved ahead and leased that building, and currently it's under the auspices of using it for classroom space. But right now they would like to move off of that, and this bill would allow them to do what makes sense.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you. I believe that's probably under a lease levy. If we could, I'd like... You know, they're leasing this building, it looks like, on a long-term basis as opposed to building a building. And, of course, if we build a building, you need to do a capital levy and the lease and all that, a capital levy and that sort of thing go to the taxpayers. If you lease the building, I assume, over this time period, you don't have to do that. And so I'm just wondering about the different, am I off here someplace? Maybe Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow could explain to me or explain to the committee the issues involved with leasing a building that you end up owning versus doing a capital building a building where you do a capital levy.
Representative Demmer, I'm going to call on Mr. Crow, but we're so used to saying Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow, but did you notice?
Oh.
Mr. Strom isn't here today. He's actually, I fall into that too. Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow?
I made the error of the assumption to assume.
Mr. Strom is actually home with us with his sick child, so we hope he's back soon and that his child is feeling better. But Mr. Crow.
Yeah, and Madam Chair and Representative Demmer, that the issue of lease purchase is one that the legislature looked pretty closely at about 10 years ago, and that was when a lot of the limitations were put in place. The concern was that was exactly what you said, that districts not be able to basically have a building built or constructed and purchased without voter approval, basically, was one of the concerns. And so one of the limitations that was placed on it was that it be for instructional space, and there are some limits on new construction, how much new construction can be, and, you know, size-wise. And so I think it's a fair question for the district as to what the goal was, and obviously from the district standpoint on the levy side of it, if this isn't as bad as the foreign equalization has gotten, there isn't much trade-off for a district like this in terms of whether they do a debt service levy versus a lease levy in terms of the school's finances. Now, and so, you know, if the debt program was more highly equalized, then those considerations would come into play for a district as well.
Representative Emery.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. I understand the fiscal implications can be different depending on aid and that sort of thing, but there is a difference. A lease levy does not require voter approval. Is that correct? Whereas a capital levy would.
Right.
So in essence, this school district will end up owning a building that they purchased without any kind of voter approval because they're doing it through a lease as opposed to building it. Is that a fair assumption,
Mr. Crow?
Madam Chair, Representative Dimmer, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, you know, as I'm talking to Representative Demmer, that he's not noticing Mr. Stromison here. I did not notice we had Ms. Larson here, and I wasn't looking around for that. And so I'm going to ask, since some of you don't serve on the committees that she has staff normally, I'm going to ask Ms. Larson to please introduce herself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Larson. I work for House Research, and I ordinarily staff the Education Policy Committee.
But when we get around to marking up the omnibus bill, she will be here as well, because then we'll have some policy questions for her as well. So welcome. Sorry I didn't see you sooner. All right. Is there any testimony from the public on this bill? Okay. Having heard none, then, do you have any final comments, Representative?
Actually, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Demmer's question, I mean, I think this, it goes to the idea of just making sense. And if we need to make the law reflect making sense, you know, I'm in favor of that. In this situation, if we don't allow the school to do this, you know, they're going to basically, they have the ability to put classrooms in there. It won't be what the school district needs. It won't be it just won't be systematically the right thing to do. So if that's going to what might hold this up, then I would like to maybe know that as ahead of time as much as I can to make sure that this happens, because it really, this is long-term impacts, and I kind of respect where you're coming from, but I also want to make sure that we can do what's best for our school district. So,
and since they're just swapping the space, it's not like they're,
it really isn't that
trying to do something tricky or anything.
Yes, thank you.
Yep, thank you very much. And again, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The next bill is Representative Tilbury, House File 410. Representative Tilbury, do you want me to move the bill, or did you have a member of the committee moving your bill?
Would you move the bill for him, please?
Yes, I will. I will move House File 410 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and welcome Representative Tilbury. If you could tell us about your bill and introduce your witness.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. Once again, I'm Representative Tom Tilbury. And I'm here today to introduce the superintendent of schools for Fridley Schools. What's interesting about Fridley Schools is this is the school that I served on the school board, so I wanted to let you know that. There's a couple of items that I wanted to let you know about Fridley Schools also. Just some highlights that I would like to touch on, where they have worked real hard in what they've been doing. Number one, they have a curriculum-wide IB program that they're moving towards that they've gotten grants for, and that's the direction that they're heading. Every child takes a world language from fifth grade on, and they also have the Chinese language. They also have Project Lead the Way, which is a pre-engineering program, and then they also were the seventh applicant for QCOMP. And the reason I bring those three things up is they've been real progressive in the way that they've operated and what they've wanted to do. There's three other facts I want to share before we get into this description. 40% of the population at Fridley are free and reduced lunch, where the state average is 30%. The growing diversity population, they're hitting nearly 40%, which and also the ELL population is very high. And the third item is buildings that are aging. I would say there was a tornado that hit in 65, and that's basically when the buildings were all put into place, so they have high maintenance issues. And why we're bringing this other area forth and why I mentioned some of these other things is that I really do feel that Fridley Schools is working towards progressive ways to educate our children and ones that are very popular with the other committees that I'm serving on. So I'm going to turn this over to our Superintendent Mark Robertson.
Welcome, Superintendent Robertson, and if you could introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Robertson, and I'm here representing Fridley School District today. And I want to thank Representative Tilbury for submitting this to the committee. I'll just try to recap quickly Fridley's situation, and it may or may not be unique to Fridley, but we have an aging population in our community. That's part of the story. We have an increasing poverty level. And our elementary schools have much higher poverty level than our secondary schools, as well as the students of color in our student population. And we have 5 buildings in our school district. This is one of the older ones. This is a pre-tornado 1965 building as Representative Tilbury said, it has some fairly high maintenance costs on it. We share that building. We have a great partnership with the city of Fridley, and we have co-location and sharing of facilities there. And actually, a number of years ago, long before I came to Fridley, the city partnered with Fridley School District to actually build a large wing on essentially an old elementary school and revamp it because of I think it's somewhat unique to Fridley when I look at that community. The people, that city was built up very rapidly in the 50s. No one left Fridley. Not literally, but close to that. And it has an incredibly large contingent of people that are over 65 years old. And it's actually led to kind of a decline of the population of Fridley. At one time, there were 5,800 students in the 70s, and it dropped to about 2,500. And it was in a long taper for about 15 years. I'm happy to report that in an area of declining enrollment, the last 2 years, we're up about 200 students. So we're holding our own and actually beating the odds a little bit. But our situation is somewhat unique because of the aging population and the poverty levels of our families that we serve. The building that we're talking about is the Fridley Community Center, a repurposed elementary building that we added a new wing several years ago in conjunction with the city. It houses 3 programs, basically our Area Learning Center. It houses our community ed programs, and it houses city programs in that building. They actually office there, and they have the largest wing of the building, then a very active senior program there. We have building costs of about $250,000 per year for maintenance on that building. We recoup that portions of that from the people that are served in that building. The city reimburses us with part of our mutual agreement to $90,000 tune per year. We recoup from our ALC $45,000 a year in rent for maintenance costs that they pay back, and then we have some rental reimbursement for about $25,000 per year. We could rent the space more if we had it freed up more, but the rooms are tied up all day long and much of the evening in the ALC side of it, and then we have a strong, and the community ed side of it, they have a strong early childhood program there, so there's not a lot of free space that we are able to rent out. The school district subsidizes that building and the community ed program to the tune of $55,000 per year also, on top of what we charge out for those constituents that are using that, which still leaves us in a deficit mode of nearly $50,000 per year. We've watched this for a number of years, and the gap continues to widen. We are trying to watch labor costs. We are trying to watch how we staff that. We're trying to be creative in a number of ways, but the truth of the matter is that we're in a difficult spot, because if we charge higher rent to those portions that are using that, then it will drive off those people that are using that, and if you charge seniors a lot more to participate in those programs, it creates sort of a problem for us. And so that is the bill that is what's being put in this file. And the proposal is to allow Fridley School District to levy $30 per pupil to help close that gap, so that we don't have to take it out. In addition to the $55,000, we don't have to subsidize the other $45,000 or $50,000 that exists. Ironically, in listening to the Spring Lake Park portion that just came here, if we didn't own the building, we could, I think, go out and do this with a levy. But we happen to own the building, and we are reluctant to sell the building to turn around and lease it because we only have 5 buildings in the school district. So that's a brief summary.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Robertson. Members, any questions? Representative Garofalo.
Just a question for Mr. Crow. I almost said Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow as well.
It's tempting, isn't it?
These sorts of levies, are school districts allowed the opportunity to request voters to do this, or under voter-approved levies, is that not an option?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, a district can go out and ask for voter approval to basically, regardless of what they ask for and put on the question, the money just goes into the district's general fund and has to be available for any purpose. So a district could do a levy and spend the money that levy generated on this purpose, a voter-approved operating levy. So in other words, even if a district says this is for class size reduction, there's nothing. The law doesn't allow that money to be specified for that once it's actually collected by the district. So that kind of a different point. But regardless of, so they could go out and ask for this amount of money and say this is what it's for, and the voters could approve it, or they could just go out and ask for money for whatever purpose, and the money could be spent on this.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
and to the testifier. Are there financial disincentives the state currently has in the form of equalization that would sort of discourage you from not going to the voters and asking for this?
Superintendent Robertson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we are a blue-collar community. And I will just tell you this, that we had a levy 2 years ago, voter-approved levy. Portion, when I talk about the $55,000 that we are subsidizing this building with already, that was, we asked for that, and the voters voted for that 2 years ago. Okay, the problem isn't that $55,000, it's the additional shortfall that it is beyond that, and we felt that we went to them with the right dollar amount because it passed 51-49%. We felt we pushed the limit. Okay, and so that's part of our problem. If it was a 60-40, then we would have under levied, you know, and but we felt we pushed it right to the maximum on that. So.
Okay.
To the testifier, I understand the dynamics of not wanting to go back to the voters and ask them again, and it's easier to get us to say yes than them. My question was, is that under the current state financing system, I know that sometimes when school districts increase their voter-approved levies, they actually lose equalization. And I was wondering I understand the answer you gave me before, but was that part of the reason why you came to us, or was it because you, again, would prefer not to go to the voters? And
Superintendent Robertson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure I can answer that part of the equalization factor. I would, I know that it would be difficult for us to go out and ask for a levy at this point in time.
We have two more questions, and then we're going to go on to the next bill. Representative Detmer, and then Representative Denver. Representative Detmer.
This is just a comment. I'm still mad at Fridley for taking Mr. Robertson away from Forest Lake.
So
we enjoyed having him in our district.
Well, there's a vote against you, Representative.
I didn't anticipate that.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the Superintendent. Do you currently have an override levy?
I'm sorry?
Do you currently have an operating levy?
Yes, we do.
For Superintendent Robertson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, we do have a current levy, operating
okay.
levy.
I guess so.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a comment, Madam Chair, you know, we have lots of, we have voter-approved levies in our education system. We have some non-voter-approved levies in our education system that we have in place. And, you know, I understand completely the motivation for wanting to do this. I think Representative Garoppolo hit right on it. The concern that I have is there'd be no end to school districts wanting to do special levies for community centers for different things where they don't think they could pass a levy with their voters or increase a levy with their voters. And I just think we should proceed with caution as we look at these individual requests, Madam Chair, because I think your box would get filled up if we start approving all of these. And we'll have these no ending. Because every school district would love to do something, and like Representative Garofalo said, it's much quicker to come here and get a committee to approve it than go through the process of getting the voters to approve it.
Representative Demmer, everything we do here is precedent-setting. Representative Tilbury, do you have any closing comments?
Closing comments that I would have is just to reiterate again that I really do feel that Fridley Schools are progressive in what they are thinking as far as going out and doing the IB program before it became popular to do so. And those other items that I mentioned, I think they're at the forefront of what we were looking for in schools. So when we come for these kinds of things, I think that if it was a school that wasn't really putting out, then I think maybe you could use that type of explanation. But I think in this case, we need that extra money, and I know that in reality to go out to the voters at this time is not going to make it.
Thank you very much, and I actually forgot to ask for public testimony. Is there any public testimony on this bill? Okay, hearing none then. Thank you very much, Superintendent Robertson and Representative Tilbury, and we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So thank you.
Thank you.
House File 776, Representative Benson is right there in the bullpen.
What a mean sliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am a member of
the committee. You can go ahead.
I am a member of the committee. My name is John Benson, representing 43B, Minnetonka, Plymouth. And I'm here to move House File 776 and recommend it its layover for possible inclusion in the K-12 Omnibus Finance Bill.
Representative Benson moves House File 776 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much, and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm here on a very enjoyable mission today. Having spent my career in education, as you know, it did not take long for me to realize that if children were to be successful in school, one of the basic needs was adequate nutrition. And even the federal government, several generations ago, came to the understanding that if school lunches were provided for children, there would be a great benefit to the society in better learning outcomes. And so I'm here today ask the committee to consider an increase in the school lunch aid program from 10.5 cents to 12 cents per lunch, which has a cost of approximately $3 million for the biennium. I would like to take note of the green sheet we received from the Caucus Research Department. It says under item 4, which discusses this bill. Yes?
This is a constant situation we have in this committee, but, you know, each caucus gets their own sheet. So the green sheet is for Democrats. And Representative Garofalo, what color is your sheet today? Oh, my God.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Well, that's very confusing. We've got to get different colors in this committee, right?
Madam Chair, in earlier years before I decided to go into education, I thought of applying for the CIA. I now understand why that was not happening.
Representative Benson, you have warmed our hearts, and we're warmed up for your bill now. Representative Benson, you could never mind about the green sheet. What's the point you want to make?
Thank you for saving me from that.
This is a serious issue, actually.
Yes, it is.
And sorry for the levity that I introduced here. Anyway, I discovered after winning this election that there were other issues which were left over from previous legislative sessions. I thought we were just dealing with adequately funding education, and something about health care, and something about property tax, and also transportation. But I find that in year 2003, and I want to emphasize I was not here and did not vote for these cuts, the legislature, in its wisdom, chose to cut the school lunch program contribution from the state of Minnesota by approximately 22%. And that has caused great difficulty for the school districts throughout this state. And so today, this bill is asking for a very moderate increase of 9.3% over the biennium, which, combined with the increase that was voted in 2005, we may be equal to where we were back in 2003. That is, if we do not include inflationary costs. So at this point, I would like to turn over to the committee, to witnesses, and then Keith, Minnesota School Nutrition Association, she represents, and Sherry Knudsen, who's good enough to come here today, who's a coordinator of school nutrition from the Rochester Public Schools. And we have a small treat, and that is there will be a small demonstration, which will be quite beneficial, as long as Senator Markey doesn't find out.
Representative Benson, now he's my senator, and so it's hard to know if he'll find out or not. But if but I won't tell him.
Oh, good.
Is it going to be Ms. Keith? Okay, please welcome to the committee, and you know the drill.
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keith, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. And we do have props, but we didn't actually intend to serve them. So,
although I can tell my senator after all, right?
Yeah, yeah. the members of our association are school nutrition directors, dietitians, cooks, and cafeteria servers. And our members work very hard to provide healthy school meals to Minnesota school children every day that are not only nutritious but low in cost and appealing to the students. And that's a very difficult balancing act. The vast majority of school districts cannot cover the cost of a school lunch through the traditional combination of the student payments, federal funding, and state funding. According to the Minnesota Department of Education, we fall short by about 43 cents on the average for every lunch that we serve. And schools are expected these days by their school boards and administrators to run a nutrition program that is self-supporting. And so we make up that 43-cent gap between the revenues that we receive and the cost of producing a school lunch by selling a la carte items. Unfortunately, many of the most popular a la carte items tend to be of low nutritional value, the things like bags of chips and so forth. We essentially make a profit on that and use that to subsidize the healthy school lunch. That's the economic reality that our nutrition programs are dealing with. We're asking the legislature to help us improve the nutritional content of our meals by providing an additional 1.5 cents for every school lunch that we serve. And that additional funding will do two things. It will help us to purchase more nutritious items that tend to be more costly, like fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains, and at the same time to help us reduce our dependence on those a la carte sales. And let me give you some examples of the additional cost of the healthier items. This is where the show and tell comes in. So a fresh apple costs on the average 16 cents. The equivalent amount of canned applesauce, which also meets the federal nutrition guidelines, costs 11 cents. That nickel doesn't sound like much, but that's a 45% difference. And when you're dealing on a large scale, that makes a big difference. The fresh apple costs more, but it also has twice the fiber, 2.5 times the vitamin A, 4 times the vitamin C, nearly twice as much vitamin K, and 50% more magnesium. And so I think it's worth it to serve that to our kids, but we need the resources in order to do that. Here's my next one. Half a cup of broccoli costs 25 cents. Half a cup of frozen broccoli, which I did not bring, costs 15 cents. That's a 67% difference. And I won't go through the nutritional content with you, but you get the idea. In addition, of course, to the higher purchase price for the fresh fruits and vegetables, they have a shorter shelf life, and so that adds an additional cost. A whole grain hamburger bun typically costs between 1 and 2 cents more than a white hamburger bun. And again, that may not sound much, like much, but on the when you're serving hundreds of meals a day, it adds up in a big hurry. You have in your packets a number of newspaper articles. Actually, they were just distributed. The first several deal with the efforts that schools are making to serve healthier meals. So we have headlines like New Frontiers in the Lunchroom. School lunch is healthier. Fries are out. Fruit is in on the new menu. Students bite into healthful foods at Challenger Elementary School, and so forth and so on. I mean, there's a lot of good news out there, and we're working very hard at this. The last couple of articles in your packet are about the childhood obesity epidemic. And it's clear that we need to teach our children better eating habits. One of the articles says that according to the Centers for Disease Control, if children continue with the current state of their eating habits, that they estimate that in the future 30 to 40% of them will become diabetics. It may not show up until they're adults, but that has staggering implications for our healthcare system. So we need to teach our kids better eating habits, and school nutrition programs want and need to be part of the solution, and we hope you will help us to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Keith. And before we go to Ms. Knudsen, I just have to tell the committee, I don't know how many people actually saw this article when it was in the paper, but I did, and I had not made tater tot hot dish for probably 20 years, and it sounded so good. I went home and made it, and then Shannon Patrick's family had it too, but in her case, she did not read the article. She did not make it. Her husband read the article, and he made it. So the power of suggestion for healthy eating we would like our children to have works on adults as well. Ms. Knudsen, welcome to the committee, and if you could please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sherry Knudsen, and I'm the coordinator of student nutrition services for the Rochester Public School District and also president of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. The 2,700 school food service employees who are members of this association, thank you for your continued support and for the half-cent increase that we received last year. It is true, and you've probably heard this saying before, that we serve education daily. And it's getting harder and harder for those of us as operators to serve children the nutritious foods that they need every day at school. Since the implementation by President Truman of the National School Lunch Act in 1946, millions of Minnesota children are served lunch in school cafeterias that follow USDA guidelines. We must follow the requirements that include serving for every lunch 2 ounces of protein, a half a cup of fruit, a half a cup of vegetables, a serving of grains, and 8 ounces of fluid milk every day. This fall, the majority of us returned back to school with wellness policies in place. USDA challenged schools to address the crisis of overweight children by implementing measures to address 4 key areas. Those 4 key areas are physical activity, nutrition education in the classroom, food served on campus, and the school meals program. You might sit there and wonder, how are we reacting to this challenge and the wellness policies? Well, one of the things that many of us are doing, we're serving more fresh fruits and vegetables. Actually, Jean Ronnie, the food service director for St. Paul, which you just graciously showed her picture, she is doing phenomenal work in this area. For those of you that have read about what Jean is doing in the St. Paul School District, one of the things that she's doing that I think is just really great fun is she has put vegetable bars in her elementary school, and the students are able to have contests to select the types of vegetables that they would like to sample on a monthly basis. I believe the vegetables that they are sampling this month are pickled beets and the potato-like vegetable jicama. So other schools are doing other initiatives. I can share with you that in the Rochester Public School District, in 2002, we spent $55,000 total on fresh produce. This year in the school, 2006-2007, we will spend way over $200,000 on fresh produce. That's a 400% increase. And as Elaine mentioned, we're really trying to put more fresh fruits and vegetables in front of our students every single day in the lunchroom. We're serving healthier entrees such as grilled chicken and low-fat pizzas, stir fries, make-your-own sandwiches on whole grain breads. I bought a few samples today. This is a very typical hoagie sandwich that can be made for order in our school cafeterias in Rochester. Whole grain breads, low-fat meat, low-fat cheeses, and students can come up and order the type of sandwich that they would like to have for lunch every day. We're trying to serve, as I mentioned, more fresh fruits and salads. This would be an example of a reimbursable meal. I mentioned about the requirements for the 2 ounces of protein, the fresh fruits and vegetables. This particular type of meal is something that you would see in many high school cafeterias in Minnesota, where they can get a packaged lunch of a salad that includes those different requirements with yogurt or cheese as the protein, and they can just add a carton of milk to complete their meal. Or if they don't like the fruit, they could choose perhaps a turkey salad, for example. A la carte. We've heard much about how most school districts need to sell a la carte items to supplement the reimbursement that we're not getting from the state and federal governments. Can we do away with a la carte? I will sit here today and I say, I don't believe so, but I think the challenge for us as food service operators in the front line is to find healthy a la carte items to put in front of our students every single day. And they're out there. It's just a matter of finding them and being willing to pay the cost for them. We package fresh fruit like this every day and sell it a la carte in our school cafeterias. We make side salads like this that students can purchase as an a la carte option if they want to have just a little bit less of a menu selection for lunch. Fresh fruit is always available as an a la carte. We're selling a lot more beverages, 100% juices, water, low-fat milks to students as a la carte choices. Another thing that's important, how we're meeting that challenge, I believe, is to involve students. Students are our customers. We need to hear from them. Many school districts, such as Montemedi, St. Paul School District, and in Rochester, we have what we call student input groups, where we meet with students periodically throughout the year and let them taste test some of the new products that are out there in the market and let them tell us what they would like to see in their school cafeterias. The number of children that we feed in Minnesota in school lunch is on the increase. Our goal for the Minnesota School Nutrition Association is to continue to provide children a nutritious meal every day. We thank you for your support. We are going to continue to ask for your support as we move forward with these nutritious foods.
Thank you, Ms. Knudsen. Representative Demmer, and then Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. I think it's good that we do our school lunch. I think it was, Ms. Keith, you may remind me, was it last year, the year before I carried the bill, we tried to do some funding for nutritious lunches and that sort of thing. Did some good work there. But I guess my question, Madam Chair, and I guess it's for a little more historical perspective regarding school lunches. We've had multiple breakfast programs. We've had changes in our school lunch program. And also, the school lunch program, I believe, is funded predominantly federally, or at least a big part of it is. And I guess if I could ask Mr. Crow to give us the breakdown of federal versus state funding for our school lunch program, if he knows that. And also, give us a little perspective on Representative Benson made a comment about cutting school lunches by 22%. And I'd like a little perspective, if you could, Mr. Crow, in the last, say, 6 years, what's happened with our school programs and the monies we've put in and how that's looked and where that figure might have come from.
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, I don't have the federal... I have $99 million for lunch programs, federal funds, for fiscal 2005, and the state appropriation that year for lunch was about $8 million, so about 90% federal, about 8%, 93% federal funding in that particular program. In the 2003 session, the appropriation for school lunches was reduced by a little over $1 million per year, and which on a percentage basis amounted to about a 12% per year cut. I didn't calculate it on the cents reimbursement, what percentage that is. I guess I could do that fairly quickly. And then in 05,
we added back, that's when the funding went back up and the appropriation increased. That year, we were down to about 7.9 million dollars for 04 and 05 in the 03 session, and then for 06 and 07, we're added back about $1 million, went up to about $9 million a year for school lunches in the state appropriation. And then for this year, the base amount for school lunches is about $10.5 million per year. And I think what else you asked me? Did I cover just about everything?
Madam Chair. Representative Emmer.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, in 03, I think what we did, actually, we had some doubling up of some programs. We had like two breakfast programs, if I'm not mistaken. And it seems to me that one of the changes we made, we consolidated the breakfast programs, which did result in savings. And I'm wondering if that's where a lot of that money came.
I'm going to call on Ms. Keith, who's trying to get in here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative Emmer, yeah, your memory is on the right track. In 2003, the total cut to nutrition, which includes three line items, school lunch, school breakfast, and summer food service, which wasn't touched, but that's a very small item, was $6,385,000, so almost 6.4, and that's where the 22% figure comes from overall. And you're right, the bulk of the cut was in breakfast. We had two breakfast programs, the traditional school breakfast program, which is very similar to lunch, where you have the three categories, free, reduced, and paid, and that's the one that's still in existence. And then we had a separate one that was targeted at elementary schools, where 33% or more of the lunches were served free or reduced. And that provided a much higher level of reimbursement, and breakfast was provided free of charge to all students in those high-poverty schools. And that's the program that was eliminated. There was also a cut in the kindergarten milk program.
And Representative Benson, you were trying to get a comment as well.
Presenter here presented it better than I, but I wanted to mention that's what the cut was in the milk for kindergarten and in the breakfast program. But in my mind, it's all part of the same lunch program. That's how I see it. We're talking about kids who need nutrition so they can study.
Thank you very much. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Demmer, I think, asked most of what I wanted to ask to sort of get a scope and history here. But I just wonder if Representative Benson or the testifiers can comment. I do a lot of grocery shopping in my home, and my bill doesn't get cheaper. And we're actually smarter at what we're buying, and we're also buying healthier, and there's less of us, at home nowadays, but, it's just not a cheaper bill. And so can you speak a little bit about, what effects you've seen in terms of inflationary costs to these programs, and what the relationship of this proposal would be relative to meeting inflationary costs?
I'll turn it over to our presenter here, but I just would say...
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mariani. One of the courses I taught was economics, and only in the legislature is inflation not counted. in fact, I asked the presenters a number of times, is this a sufficient request? Because in my mind, we ought to be also covering inflation. And also, on top of that, these other products, the healthy foods, tend, I think, to be more expensive to provide. So there ought to be a consideration for that. But I'm one of these fellows who believe I'll take a half a loaf rather than nothing. I'll turn it over to you, and maybe you can answer it better, either of you.
Madam Chair and members, I think Ms. Knutson can probably answer better the question about the increase in food costs that they're seeing at the school district level, so I'll let her answer. But I do want to mention that we did 2 years ago come in with a very ambitious proposal, which is the one that Representative Demmer is talking about, that he was gracious enough to carry for us. We asked for an additional 10 cents per lunch. Now, of course, the cost of that was $20 million over the biennium, and there were some strings attached to that proposal. We said, you know, in exchange for that, we will, serve more fresh fruits and vegetables, and it was, and more whole grains and more low-fat milk, et cetera, et cetera. It was a pretty prescriptive bill, but we wanted to move in that direction. Essentially, I think what the legislature told us was, we appreciate the direction we're moving in. We want you to do that. We can't afford to give you the amount of money that you're asking for or anything close to that. And so we were granted a more modest increase. It was 2 cents per lunch increase in 2005 and then another half cent in the 2006 session, with the understanding that although there were not strings in the law attached to that, that we were moving in the right direction, and I think you can see the results. Obviously, the more you give us, the faster we could move in the correct direction.
Thank you, Ms. Knudsen, and you'll be the final word before testimony from the public, if there is any.
Madam Chair, I think the analogy that he brought up is true for all of us. When we go to the grocery store, it is costing us more to put food on the table at home, and it's no different in school lunch where we're buying in mass quantities. To buy a breaded chicken product is certainly less costly than to buy a whole breast of chicken and grill it, for example. So I think that we can all make that parallel there. But just to give you, just to bring it down to a specific dollar amount, the half cent increase for the Rochester School Nutrition Services last year amounted to about a $74,000 revenue stream, which was really very well spent in trying to put these types of products in front of the students today, the fresh fruits and vegetables and the whole grains. And I really would like to add in closing that I think we need to applaud today's young students because they really, truly are aware of the health aspect of making better choices. We have been pleasantly surprised in the school lunch environment as we've switched products out in anticipating probably a little bit more turmoil than we would want to anticipate. But we've been greatly surprised to the receptiveness of students in trying to put healthier food options in front of them for breakfast.
Thank you very much, and that's very good to hear. Any public testimony for or against the bill?
I'm sorry, I just wanted to follow up.
Oh, Representative Marinetti.
Thank you. Perhaps just a quick question for Mr. Crowell in terms of the base appropriations in these programs. So do those include inflationary increases?
Mr. Crowell.
Madam Chair, Representative Marinetti, no, the base appropriation is just carried forward from the from the formula that's in law at the 10.5 cents.
So this is a very modest request. Any public testimony? Thank you very much. Then Representative Benson renews his motion for House File 776 to be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have to members move on because Representative Slavik has a bill, and we'd like to give her the same amount of time as all the other bills have had. We do have other several other legislators with questions, but we need to get to Representative Slavik's bill.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo.
May I move House File 759 for inclusion or possible inclusion in our omnibus bill?
Please. Thank you very much. Representative Garofalo moves House File 759 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and welcome Representative Slavik.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Garofalo, for moving the bill. Three points of segue. We also have props, so you know that. And the fact that they didn't share their props to eat, I thought they would at least walk their food around. But so we also have that. And then this bill is about the Minnesota Children's Museum, and they have added fresh food to their store, so they're now serving that. And the third point of segue is Representative Breiling brings her grandchild to the Minnesota Children's Museum, so we know there's connections there, and I also bring my kids there.
Mm-hmm.
I come here wearing a couple hats. I'm also on the board of the Minnesota Children's Museum, along with Representative Jeff Michelle, Senator Jeff Michelle, over in the Senate. They have a bipartisan representation, if any of you are interested at some point. I know that we kind of rotate on and off the board, and it's a very interesting board to serve on. This bill is about funding for the Minnesota Children's Museum. They serve children in 6 months to 10 years, and their families, caregivers, and teachers. The mission of the Minnesota Children's Museum is sparking children's learning through play. And maybe some of you have seen the building in downtown St. Paul, which has the big, it has the ball in the hand, right, and is very visible. The Minnesota Children's Museum serves as a statewide resource. They had 420,000 in attendance in 2006. About 18% of that, or 75,000, were from visitors from greater Minnesota, and 10%, or 42,000, of the visitors were tourists from outside Minnesota. I have two testifiers here today, and what they're going to be talking about is the request, which is for $520,000 to maintain current quality levels for 420,000 annual visitors, access programs, and community partnerships, and then $230,000 to create the pint-sized math and science program. The estimated cost per teacher or student served is $1.35. And with that, I will introduce the testifiers. Sarah Caruso, who is the president of the Minnesota Children's Museum. I've worked with her for a couple of years on my second term now, so I'm glad you're here today to talk about the museum.
Thank you.
Welcome, President Caruso.
Pardon me.
Please state your name for the record.
Sarah Caruso, president of the Minnesota Children's Museum. Thank you, Madam Chair. In your package, you have a presentation that we have prepared. We chose not to put it on PowerPoint because we really want to get to the prop part of the discussion, which will hopefully be the funnest part of your day, perhaps. But there's just a few pages I want to highlight here. The first page just reiterates our mission and that we're a statewide asset, and we have a statewide reach. And the second page really dimensionalizes that, I think, pretty conclusively. We have visitors from 85 out of 87 of the counties in Minnesota, and if you happen to represent either of the two counties that we don't currently know we have visitors from, please see me so we can arrange for some special treatment. And then also 35 counties sending their children to the museum for field trips, and that is really significant if you consider the young age of the kindergartners, first and second and third graders. There was one teacher comment card we got back that said, my kindergartners are an hour on the bus each way to come to the museum, but it's worth it. So we're very pleased to be supporting so many counties, both families and school districts. As Nora said, we have a focus on children age birth, really, through 10 years old, and we are very committed as a mission-driven organization to serve all families in Minnesota. And if you turn a couple more pages down, you'll see what we talk about is our access programs. There are four tenants of our access program. We have a free Sunday every month. This past Sunday was our free February Sunday. We had 5,000 people in the building. It was our second highest attendance day ever at the museum. So these free programs are heavily used. All school groups come at subsidized rate, either at $4.25 or at $2.25 if they qualify for have 70% of their students on subsidized school lunch. We give away 2,000 free family memberships. So 2,000 memberships to families who can come as many times as they want during the year. And we also have a strong partnership with Head Start programs and with several library systems also to bring people in for free. The next page talks about these community partnerships that we really have systemically worked to spread throughout, especially the metro area, with the St. Paul Public School as our local district, also with Head Starts, with the west side of St. Paul, with some baby space nursing programs in Minneapolis, with adolescent parent programs. We're actually bringing young parents into the museum and helping them learn how to play with their babies, a very important skill, and then, as I mentioned, our library program. So that is kind of just a very thumbnail sketch of our ongoing operations. And if there are no questions, I want to turn quickly to this pint-sized math and science program that we are proposing. In working with the Department of Education and asking how the museum can best serve the youngest learners in the state, The response we got back was actually a little surprising to us. They said teachers in early elementary and in preschool are having a hard time teaching young learners about math and science. And how can you help us really raise the field, the comfort of the field, the knowledge of the field, and the content of what they're teaching in early math and science concepts? So we developed this proposed program called Plain Science Math and Science, which would have a lot of components. It would have a web component, which would help get to as many teachers in the state and outside the state as possible. It would have some professional training, and a cornerstone would be the development of these learning trunks that we would give away for free to educators who would come to the museum and then take them back to their districts and distribute them throughout their districts for early math curriculum. And this model is something that we have done in the St. Paul district with learning trunks with great success. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Ann Beckoff, who is a longtime teacher in the St. Paul schools. We've been so fortunate to have her here at the museum for six or 7 years. She's a PhD in education, and she's going to describe these learning trunks to you.
Dr. Beckoff, please state your name for the record and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Beckoff, and I'm the Director of Experience Development and Evaluation at the Minnesota Children's Museum. We have had a learning trunk program for a few years and have worked with teachers to develop these learning trunks. The learning trunks are based on the Minnesota Academic Standards for kindergarten through third grade, and then also now on the early childhood indicators of progress. And you're receiving a handout that shows the connections between those different areas and the activities that are part of the trunk. And as part of our trunks, we always include literature, and this is the type of thing that we have in our trunks for these young children. We have both fiction and nonfiction books that connect to specific science content. For example, we have There Was the Old Lady Who Swallowed the Fly and Who Eats What, which deal with food chains and predator-prey relationships and food webs. So we have both ways of looking at that kind of science content. We also like to provide very authentic materials for children. So we have an actual butterfly net that's part of our insect trunk. And then in the lesson plans that come along with the trunk and that can be developed with school districts, we have directions for making your own butterfly net out of nylon stockings and hangers. Here's another example of the kind of things that are in the trunks. This contains plastic insects, very accurate plastic insects, and we have children use their math skills to guess how many insects are in this container, and there actually are 100 here. And then we also show them that in the population, there are, for every one mammal or one bird, there are 100 insects in the world. So they begin to see those kind of relationships. They can also use these for multiple purposes, to be able to describe insects, to be able to compare them, to sort them. So they're working on process skills in science as well. Here is another example of the kinds of materials that we have. And these materials are things that teachers are probably not going to be able to afford to purchase for their classroom, but things that we can provide. And we can provide one for each child. So we have some really wonderful insect finger puppets. And these puppets, we have enough so that an entire class can have a finger puppet. And there are many different kinds of them. They can be used, of course, for a variety of things. But one of the things that's really interesting about this is, as part of the early childhood indicators of progress, one of the things we're really working with young children on is their approach to learning and their disposition to learn. And how much more fun is it to be able to learn with finger puppets of insects than maybe looking at a drawing or a photograph of an insect? And these can be used, of course, for language skills and for creating stories and acting out things. So they have a lot of different uses and a lot of appeal for young children. We have a variety of materials in the kits that deal with different learning styles, For example, we have a whole set of things about life cycles of insects, and we have different models where you can really visually see the details. And we also have then for children who prefer a more hands-on kind of approach to be able to actually look at the life cycle of the different insects and handle those materials as well. We have stamps where the children can stamp the life cycle of the different insects. And then we also have a really wonderful card game called Go Metamorphosis, which is played like Go Fish, and you gather the four different life cycles for different insects. So you can be a mosquito, and you need to get the egg and the larva and the pupa and the adult mosquito. So there, and in this particular kit, we have five sets of these so that a whole classroom can be playing these kind of card games. And we also have information sheets that help children who are beginning to learn that so they can look at these different life cycle materials as they play the game. Okay. So that gives you a sample of the kinds of things that are part of these trunks and how we use these to make learning very concrete for children and also very interesting.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Beckhoff. I just spent the weekend playing with my 2.5-year-old granddaughter, so I'm really into these toys here today. I don't see any members on the list. Is there any public testimony? Okay, any members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Greiling. To the testifiers, especially Doctor, do you provide any of these manipulatives for the teachers who come, either for staff development or bring their students? Are they able to purchase these or get the patterns or something like that?
Dr. Becca.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
We have these on site at the museum, and we use these in classes that we have at the museum, and then we also do rent these out to schools as well. But through this program, we'd like to be able to work with the teachers, and they could kind of customize what they needed, and then they would actually have a copy themselves for their classroom.
Thank you very much. Representative Fabik, any closing comments?
Well, Madam Chair, I had a vision there for a moment that we could all take the finger puppets and do something in unison, but I know you've got other things to do today, so thank you very much. But and play is important even for adults, so we appreciate the opportunity. I want to thank the testifiers for coming. I hope you'll visit the Minnesota Children's Museum and that you'll remember that it's important in the lives of our young Minnesota children and that you also give consideration to the funding that they need to keep going and keep their program strong. So thank you,
Representative Slawick. It is a wonderful place. Thank you to your testifiers. And House File 759 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, the meeting is adjourned.